Ayrım 2.
Preface to the first edition. This book is inevitably the victim of the author's over-numerous intentions. The most workaday of these is simply to provide some historical background and perspective for the reading of those selected texts, which form the core of the study of moral philosophy in most British and American universities. In particular, I wanted to give some account of Greek thought for those undergraduate students restricted to the treadmill of Hume, Kant, Mill, and Moore. But this apparently simple intention is complicated by my views of the nature of moral philosophy. Discussion limited to an account of philosophical themes, omitting all reference to the moral concepts for the elucidation and reconstruction of which the theories were elaborated, would be absurd. A history not only of moral philosophies, but also of moral concepts and of the moralities embodying and defined by these concepts would fill 30 volumes and 30 years. I have therefore continually compromised, and nobody will be satisfied with the result. I certainly am not. No one could write in English on the history of moral philosophy and not feel awed by the example of Henry Sidgwick's Outlines of the History of Ethics, published in 1886 as a revision of his Encyclopaedia Britannica article, and intended primarily for the benefit of ordinance of the Church of Scotland. The perspective of my book is necessarily very different from that of Sidgwick, but the experience of writing has increased my admiration for him. In his journal he wrote, "Went up to London yesterday to see Macmillan about a stupid blunder in my outlines. I have represented a man whom I ought to have known all about, Sir James McIntosh, as publishing a book in 1836, 4 years after he was dead. The cause of the blunder is simple carelessness of a kind that now seems incredible." Somewhere in this book, I am sure that there must be more than one example of an equally simple carelessness. It will not, however, be about Sir James McIntosh, who does not appear. For, like Sidgwick, I have had not only to compress, but also to select. I am unhappily aware, too, that on very many points of disputed interpretation, I have had to take a point of view without being able to justify it. I could not be more certain that students of particular authors and periods will be able to find many faults. My debts are many. In general, to philosophical colleagues and pupils at Leeds, Oxford, Princeton, and elsewhere, in particular to Mr. P. F. Strawson, Mrs. Amelie Rorty, and Professor H. L. A. Hart, who read either the whole or parts of the manuscript and made of this a better book than it would otherwise have been. To them I am profoundly grateful. I am especially conscious of how much in general I owe to Princeton University and to the members of its Department of Philosophy, where I was senior fellow to the Council of the Humanities in 1962-63 and visiting professor in 1965-66. This book is in no way adequate to any of those debts. I must also thank Miss M. P. Thomas for all her secretarial help. Alistair MacIntyre. Chapter 1. The Philosophical Point of the History of Ethics. Moral philosophy is often written as though the history of the subject were only of secondary and incidental importance. This attitude seems to be the outcome of a belief that moral concepts can be examined and understood apart from their history. Some philosophers have even written as if moral concepts were a timeless, limited, unchanging, determinate species of concept, necessarily having the same features throughout their history, so that there's a part of language waiting to be philosophically investigated, which deserves the title The Language of Morals, with a definite article and a singular noun. In a less sophisticated way, historians of morals are all too apt to allow that moral practices and the content of moral judgments may vary from society to society and from person to person, but at the same time, these historians have subtly assimilated different moral concepts, and so they end up by suggesting that although what is held to be right or good is not always the same, roughly the same concepts of right and good are universal. In fact, of course, moral concepts change as social life changes. I deliberately do not write because social life changes, for this might suggest that social life is one thing, morality another, and that there is merely an external contingent causal relationship between them. This is obviously false. Moral concepts are embodied in and are partially constitutive of forms of social life. One key way in which we may identify one form of social life as distinct from another is by identifying differences in moral concepts. So it is an elementary commonplace to point out that there is no precise English equivalent for the Greek word dikaiosnep, usually translated justice. And this is not a mere linguistic defect, so that what Greek achieves by a single word, English needs a periphrasis to achieve. It is rather that the occurrence of certain concepts in ancient Greek discourse and of others in modern English marks a difference between two forms of social life. To understand a concept, to grasp the meaning of the words which express it, is always at least to learn what the rules are which govern the use of such words, and so to grasp the role of the concept in language and social life. This in itself would suggest strongly that different forms of social life will provide different roles for concepts to play. Or at least for some concepts this seems likely to be the case. There certainly are concepts which are unchanging over long periods and which must be unchanging for one of two reasons. Either they are highly specialized concepts belonging within stable and continuing disciplines, such as geometry, or else they are highly general concepts necessary to any language of any complexity. I have in mind here the family of concepts expressed by such words as and, or, and if. But moral concepts do not fall into either of these two classes. So it would be a fatal mistake to write as if, in the history of moral philosophy, there had been one single task of analyzing the concept of, for example, justice, to the performance of which Plato, Hobbes, and Bentham all set themselves, and for their achievement at which they can be awarded higher or lower marks. It does not, of course, follow, and it is in fact untrue, that what Plato says about dikaiosnep and what Hobbes or Bentham says about justice are totally irrelevant to one another. There are continuities as well as breaks in the history of moral concepts. Just here lies the complexity of the history. The complexity is increased because philosophical inquiry itself plays a part in changing moral concepts. it is not that we have first a straightforward history of moral concepts and then a separate and secondary history of philosophical comment. For to analyze a concept philosophically may often be to assist in its transformation by suggesting that it needs revision, or that it is discredited in some way, or that it has a certain kind of prestige. Philosophy leaves everything as it is, except concepts. And since to possess a concept involves behaving or being able to behave in certain ways, in certain circumstances, to alter concepts, whether by modifying existing concepts or by making new concepts available or by destroying old ones, is to alter behavior. So the Athenians who condemned Socrates to death, the English Parliament which condemned Hobbes' Leviathan in 1666, and the Nazis who burned philosophical books were correct, at least in their apprehension, that philosophy can be subversive of established ways of behaving. Understanding the world of morality and changing it are far from incompatible tasks. The moral concepts, which are objects for analysis to the philosophers of one age, may sometimes be what they are, partly because of the discussions by philosophers of a previous age. A history which takes this point seriously, which is concerned with the role of philosophy in relation to actual conduct, cannot be philosophically neutral, for it cannot but be at odds with the view of all those recent philosophers who have wanted sharply to distinguish philosophical ethics as a second-order activity of comment from the first-order discourse, which is part of the conduct of life, where moral utterances themselves are in place. In drawing this distinction, such philosophers have tried so to define the realm of philosophy that it would be a conceptual truth that philosophy could not impinge upon practice. A. J. Ayer, for instance, has written about one particular ethical theory that it is entirely on the level of analysis. It is an attempt to show what people are doing when they make moral judgments. It is not a set of suggestions as to what moral judgments they are to make. And this is true of all moral philosophy as I understand it. All moral theories, ... so far as they are philosophical theories, are neutral as regards actual conduct. Footnote: On the Analysis of Moral Judgments in Philosophical Essays, pages 245-246. My quarrel with this view will emerge from time to time in these essays. But what I hope will emerge even more clearly is the function of history in relation to conceptual analysis, for it is here that Santayana's epigram, that he who is ignorant of the history of philosophy is doomed to repeat it, finds its point. It is all too easy for philosophical analysis, divorced from historical inquiry, to insulate itself from correction. In ethics, it can happen in the following way. A certain unsystematically selected class of moral concepts and judgments is made the subject of attention. From the study of these, it is concluded that specifically moral discourse possesses certain characteristics. When counterexamples are adduced to show that this is not always so, these counterexamples are dismissed as irrelevant because not examples of moral discourse, and they are shown to be non-moral by exhibiting their lack of the necessary characteristics. From this kind of circularity, we can be saved only by an adequate historical view of the varieties of moral and evaluative discourse. This is why it would be dangerous, and not just pointless, to begin these studies with a definition which would carefully delimit the field of inquiry. We cannot, of course, completely avoid viewing past moralists and past philosophers in terms of present distinctions. To set out to write the history of moral philosophy at all involves us in selecting from the past what falls under the heading of moral philosophy as we now conceive it. But it is important that we should, as far as it is possible, allow the history of philosophy to break down our present-day preconceptions so that our too narrow views of what can and cannot be taught, said, and done are discarded in face of the record of what has been taught, said, and done. We have to steer between the danger of a dead antiquarianism, which enjoys the illusion that we can approach the past without preconceptions, and that other danger, so apparent in such philosophical historians as Aristotle and Hegel, of believing that the whole point of the past was that it should culminate with us. History is neither a prison nor a museum, nor is it a set of materials for self-congratulation. Chapter 2. The Pre-Philosophical History of Good and the Transition to Philosophy. The suggestion that asking and answering moral questions is one thing, and asking and answering philosophical questions about morality quite another thing, may conceal from us the fact that, in asking moral questions of a certain kind with sufficient persistence, we may discover that we cannot answer them until we have asked and answered certain philosophical questions. A discovery of this kind provided the initial impulse for philosophical ethics in Greek society. For at a certain period, when moral questions were asked, it became clear that the meaning of some of the key words involved in the framing of those questions was no longer clear and unambiguous. Social changes had not only made certain types of conduct, once socially accepted, problematic, but had also rendered problematic the concepts which had defined the moral framework of an earlier world. The social changes in question are those reflected in Greek literature in the transition from the Homeric writers through the Theognid corpus to the Sophists. The society reflected in the Homeric poems is one in which the most important judgments that can be passed upon a man concern the way in which he discharges his allotted social function. It is because certain qualities are necessary to discharge the function of a king or a warrior, a judge or a shepherd, that there is a use for such expressions as authoritative and courageous and just. The word agathos, ancestor of our good, is originally a predicate specifically attached to the role of a Homeric nobleman. To be agathos, says W. H. Atkins, one must be brave, skillful and successful in war and in peace, and one must possess the wealth and, in peace, the leisure which are at once the necessary conditions for the development of these skills and the natural reward of their successful employment. Footnote: Merit and Responsibility in Greek Ethics, pages 32-33. Agathos is not like our word good in many of its Homeric contexts, for it is not used to say that it is good to be kingly, courageous, and clever. That is, it is not used to command these qualities in a man, as our word good might be used by a contemporary admirer of the Homeric ideal. It is rather that Agathos, is a commendatory word because it is interchangeable with the words which characterize the qualities of the Homeric ideal. So in our ordinary English use of good, good but not kingly, courageous or cunning, makes perfectly good sense. But in Homer, agathos, but not kingly, courageous or clever, would not even be a morally eccentric form of judgment, but as it stands, simply an unintelligible contradiction. How do adjectives of appraisal, such as agathos and others, function in Homer? First of all, to ascribe the qualities for which they stand to someone is to make a factual statement, in the sense that whether what you have said is true or false is settled by the man's performances and settled simply and solely by his performances. The question, is he agathos, is the same as the question, is he courageous, clever and kingly? And this is answered by answering the question, does he and has he fought, plotted and ruled with success? The point of such ascriptions is in part predictive. To call a man agathos is to tell your hearers what sort of conduct they can expect from him. We ascribe these positions to the agent in the light of his behavior in past episodes. From this alone, it is strikingly plain that the Homeric use of agathos does not square at all with what many recent philosophers have taught to be the characteristic properties of moral and indeed of evaluative predicates. For it has often been held to be an essential feature of such predicates that any judgments in which one is ascribed to a subject cannot follow logically as a conclusion from premises which are merely factual. Footnote. For later discussions, see Chapter 12, page 157, and Chapter 18, page 249. No matter what factual conditions are satisfied, these by themselves can never provide sufficient conditions for asserting that an evaluative predicate holds of a subject. But in the Homeric poems, that a man has behaved in certain ways is sufficient to entitle him to be called agathos. Now assertions as to how a man has behaved are certainly in the ordinary sense factual, and the Homeric use of agathos is certainly in the ordinary sense evaluative. The alleged logical gulf between fact and appraisal is not so much one that has been bridged in Homer. It has never been dug, nor is it clear that there is any ground in which to dig. Moreover, I fail to be agathos if and only if I fail to bring off the requisite performances. And the function of expressions of praise and blame is to invoke and to justify the rewards of success and the penalties of failure. You cannot avoid blame and penalty by pointing out that you could not help doing what you did, that failure was unavoidable. You may, of course, certainly point this out, but if your performance failed to satisfy the appropriate criteria, then you simply cannot prevent the withdrawal of the ascription of kingliness, courage, and cleverness or cunning. And this is to say that Homeric moral predicates are not applied, as moral predicates have been applied in our society, only where the agent could have done other than he did. Excuses, praise, and blame must all play different parts. We cannot even inquire whether, in the Kantian sense, ought implies can for Homer, for in Homer we cannot find ought in the Kantian sense. So Odysseus blames the suitors when he returns to Ithaca for having had a false belief. Dogs, You did not think that I would return home from Troy, for you have consumed my possessions, lain with my maidservants by force, and wooed my wife while I was yet alive, fearing neither the gods who inhabit the broad heaven, nor yet that there would be any retaliation from man hereafter. But now the doom of death is upon you all. Footnote: Odysseus, Book 22. The suitors are blamed precisely for having a false belief. But this is what, in a modern sense, we would feel we could not blame people for. For to believe is not to perform an avoidable action. And it is not that Homer thinks that beliefs are voluntary. He is engaged in an assessment to which what the agent could or could not have done otherwise is irrelevant. It will be useful now to look at a cognate of agathos in Homer. The noun arete, usually and perhaps misleadingly translated virtue. A man who performs his socially allotted function possesses arete. The arete of one function or role is quite different from that of another. The arete of a king lies in ability to command, of a warrior in courage, of a wife in fidelity, and so on. A man is agathos if he has the arete of his particular and specific function. And this brings out the divorce of agathos in the Homeric poems from the later uses of good, including later uses of agathos. When Agamemnon intends to steal the slave girl Briseis from Achilles, Nestor says to him, "Do not, agathos though you be, take the girl from him." Footnote: Iliad, Book 1. It is not that, being agathos, Agamemnon can be expected not to take the girl, nor that he will cease to be agathos if he does take her. He will be agathos whether he takes her or not. The way in which agathos is tied so completely to fulfillment of function is also brought out in its links with other concepts. Shame, eidos, is what is felt by a man who fails to perform his allotted role. To feel shame is simply to be aware that you have entitled people to accuse you of having fallen short of that which the socially established description both you and others had applied to yourself had led them to expect. It is to be aware that one is liable to reproach. This whole family of concepts, then, presupposes a certain sort of social order characterized by a recognized hierarchy of functions. It is noteworthy that the value predicates can only be applied to those men who fall under the descriptions which taken together constitute the social vocabulary of the system. Those who fall outside the system fall outside the moral order. And this is indeed the fate of slaves. The slave becomes a chattel, a thing rather than a person. It would miss the point to comment upon this that the Homeric poems are not a historically accurate picture of early Greek society, or that no society as rigorously functional in fact existed. What we get in Homer is rather an idealization of one form of social life. We are presented with a social order and its concepts in a fairly pure form, rather than in the kind of admixture of several forms which a total society often presents. But for our conceptual purposes, this is none of the worse, for we have other literary documents in which we can see how the breakdown of a social hierarchy and of a system of recognized functions deprives the traditional moral terms and concepts of their social anchorage. In the body of poems, which pass under the name of Theognis of Megara, and which were written in post-Homeric and pre-classical Greeks, we find startling changes in the uses of agathos and arete. Footnote, see H. Frisch, Might and Right in Antiquity. They can no longer be defined in terms of the fulfillment in a recognized way of a recognized function, for there is no longer a single and unified society in which evaluation can depend on established criteria of this kind. Words like agathos, kakos, bad, become sometimes merely neutrally descriptive of social position, or they may acquire an even more radical extension of meaning. Both processes are seen at once in a passage which runs, many kakoi are rich and many agathoi are poor, but we will not take the wealth in exchange for our arete. For the one remains with a man always, but possessions pass from one man to another. Here, agathos and kakos seem to mean noble-born and base-born, or some such equivalents. They have lost their old meaning and been transformed into one of the key identifying descriptions under which those to whom the terms applied in their old sense now fall. But they are no longer evaluative in the same way. Whereas in Homer, one would have said of a chieftain that he was agathos, if and only if he exercised his true function, now agathos describes someone who comes of a chieftain's line, whatever function he may exercise or fail to exercise, or whatever his personal qualities may be. But the transformation of arete in the same passage is quite different. For arete now denotes not those qualities by means of which a particular function may be discharged, but certain human qualities which may be divorced from function altogether. A man's arete is now personal to himself. It has become far more like what modern writers think of as a moral quality. Thus, evaluative predicates come to refer to dispositions to behave in certain ways relatively independent of social function. With this change comes another. In Homeric society, the dominant hierarchy of functional roles determines which are the dominant qualities, skill, cunning, and courage of various sorts. When this hierarchy collapses, the question can be opened in a far more general way of what the qualities are which we would wish to see in a man. The whole of arete is summed up in Dikaione, writes one Theognet author. Every man, Cernus, is agathos if he has Dikaione. Here anybody can be agathos by exercising the quality of justice, dikaione. But what does this consist in? The pressures of the time not only make agathos unstable in meaning, they also raise doubts about the nature of dikaione. For the idea of a single moral order has broken down. It has broken down partly because of the breakdown of formerly unified social forms. These were reinforced by a mythology with the statues of sacred writing, including the Homeric poems, which suggested a single cosmic order. In Homer, the order of necessity reigns over gods as well as over men. Hubris, willful pride, is the sin of overstepping the moral order of the universe. Nemesis awaits whoever commits it. The moral order and the natural order are not sharply distinguished. The sun will not go beyond his measures. Otherwise, the Erinus, The handmaids of justice will find him out, said Heraclitus. But this mythological assertion of order changes its function too, as Greek society changes. Anthropologists very commonly assert that myths express social structure, and myths can do this in more than one way. Between Homer and writers, 5 centuries later, there is a great change in Greek myths about the order in the universe. The Homeric myth does reflect, though with much distortion, the workings of an actual society in which a close form of functional organization is presupposed by the moral and evaluative forms of appraisal which are in use. The later assertions of order in the universe reflect not a structure that is, but one that was, or one that is struggling to survive. They are conservative protests against the disintegration of the older forms and the transition to the city-state. The myths themselves cannot but open up the question of the difference between the order of the universe and the order of society. But above all, this question is sharpened by a widening awareness of radically different social orders. The impact of the Persian invasions, of colonization, of increase in trade and therefore in travel, all these bring home the fact of different cultures. The result is that the distinction between what holds good in Egypt, but not in Persia, or in Athens, but not in Megara, on the one hand, and what is the case universally as part of the order of things becomes overwhelmingly important. The question asked about any moral rule or social practice is it part of the essentially local realm of nomos, convention, custom, or of the essentially universal realm of phusis, nature? Linked to this is, of course, the question, is it open to me to choose what rules I shall make my own or what restraints I shall observe, as it may be open to me to choose which city I shall live in and what therefore shall be the nomos by which I live? Or does the nature of the universe set limits upon what I may legitimately choose? To the task of answering these questions, there came in the 5th century BC a new class of teachers and a new class of pupils. Books on moral philosophy commonly concentrated on the teachers, the sophists, whom we see mainly through the antagonistic eyes of Plato. But the activities of the sophists as suppliers are unintelligible apart from the demand which they met. So let us try to specify this demand still more precisely. We have seen how the word agathos had become unstable in its attachments, and so had its cognate words, especially arete. Virtue is what the good man possesses and exercises. It is his skill. But what virtue is and what constitutes a good man, these have become matters of conflicting opinion, in which the Homeric concept of the agathos has been divided up between rival inheritances. There is, on the one hand, the good man conceived as the good citizen. The values of the conservative Athenian, whom Aristophanes portrays, are loyalty to the city, and more especially to the older forms of social order. In this there is certainly an element of the Homeric agathos, but equally the Homeric chieftain's personal values, the values of the courageous, cunning, and aggressive king, are now, if exercised by the individual in the city-state, antisocial. Self-aggrandizement, the use of the state as something to be preyed upon, these are the only courses open to the individuals who wants in the 5th century to behave like a Homeric hero. The social order in which his qualities were an essential part of a stable society has given way to one in which the same qualities are necessarily disruptive. So the relationship of the Agathos to the social values, and especially to justice, has become a crucial issue. But Dikaiune, which, though very inadequately translated as justice, is as inadequately translated by any other word, for it has a flavor all its own and combines the notion of fairness in externals with that of personal integrity in a way that no English word does, is of all notions the one that appears most to be put in question by the discovery of rival social orders. Different cities observe different customs and different laws. Does and should justice differ from city to city? Does justice hold only within a given community between citizens, or should it hold also between cities? The Athenians condemned the character of Alcibiades because he did not observe the restraints of Dikaiuno in his behavior within the Athenian state. But their own envoys behave just like Alcibiades in their attitude to other states. That is, they equate what is morally permissible with what the agent has the power to do. Their envoys can say to the representative of Melos, an island which wished to remain neutral in the Peloponnesian War, "For of the gods we believe, and of men we know, that by a law of their nature, whether they can rule, they will. This law was not made by us, and we are not the first who have acted upon it. We did but inherit it, and shall bequeath it to all time, and we know that you and all mankind, if you were as strong as we are, would do as we do." Footnote: Thucydides, Peloponnesian War, Book 5, 105. Thus, the redefinition of evaluative predicates creates a problem for those who wish to use them, even in formulating their own intentions. The terms agathos and arete have become genuinely problematic, as has their relation to kakos, the predicate characterizing what is well thought of, and as has their relationship to dikaiuno. The moral and political conservative still feels able to give the words a fixed connotation. He uses texts and tags from Homer and Simonides to provide him with definitions, but in general, slides in the meanings of words become appallingly easy and frequent. It is often impossible to distinguish two separate phenomena, moral uncertainty and uncertainty as to the meaning of evaluative predicates. In the moments of greatest perplexity in 5th century Greece, these two uncertainties are one. Thucydides has recorded the corruption of language in describing the revolution at Corfu. The meaning of words no longer had the same relation to things, but was changed by them as they thought fit. Reckless doing was held to be loyal courage. Prudent delay was the excuse of a coward. Moderation was the disguise of unmanly weakness. To know everything was to do nothing. Footnote: Thucydides, Peloponnesian War, Book 3, 82. How does Ayer's conception of the distinction between moral philosophy and moral judgment or practice apply in this situation? Can we distinguish two separate activities, the activity of a moralist who sets out to elaborate a moral code or to encourage its observance, and that of a moral philosopher whose concern is not primarily to make moral judgments, but to analyze their nature. Footnote: Introduction to Ethics by P. H. Noel Smith. It must at once be conceded to err that there are some questions involved in moral philosophy which are purely philosophical and others which are entirely independent of philosophy. There are many cases where what is important is to emphasize that to commit oneself to a particular philosophical analysis of moral judgments does not entail committing oneself to making a particular specified set of moral judgments. In a contemporary context, two utilitarian philosophers might agree in their analysis of the expression wrong, and without a shadow of inconsistency, disagree as to whether it is the case that all wars are wrong or that only some wars are wrong. Equally, two pacifists might agree on this latter issue, but one might be a philosophical intuitionist and other an emotivist. When Ayer argues that philosophical theories of moral concepts and judgments are neutral as regards conduct, this is clearly the type of case he has in mind. But the point at which Greek moral philosophy begins suggests that there is also a quite different type of case.